You are listening to the Dharma Ocean podcast. Today, we'll listen to a talk Reggie offered on the life and teachings of his teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. He discusses the Vajrayana foundations of Tibetan Buddhism, Trungpa's early training as a Vajrayana master, and his unique expression of the Dharma in the modern world. This talk was given in 2011 as part of a class on the sadhana of Mahamudra in Boulder, Colorado.
So, a little bit of background about the sadhana. As you know, Trungpa Rinpoche, was a Tibetan. He was born in East Tibet in 1939. And Tibet is known in the Buddhist world and now in the rest of the world as a country where people practice Vajrayana Buddhism. Vajrayana Buddhism is a particular form of Buddhism that was developed in India sometime after the 3rd century of the Common Era. And it flowered in India, and we'll talk more about that. And then it went to Tibet beginning in the 8th century. And it really was the predominant form of Buddhism, at least in terms of the external form of it. But the actual fact of the matter was, as Trungpa Rinpoche says in the sadhana and in the source book that we'll be talking about, actually real Vajrayana wasn't practiced in Tibet hardly at all. What went on in Tibet was a very conventional form of Vajrayana that wasn't really Vajrayana Buddhism. And he said publicly, and he said privately a lot in the early 70s, which is when I met him. I met him in 1970, literally a couple of weeks after he arrived in the U.S. At that time, he basically said there were a handful of people in Tibet who kept the true Vajrayana alive, and that was it. And he had traveled himself, and his teachers knew the situation in Tibet well. And they basically said, almost without exception, the Vajrayana Buddhism that is practiced in Tibet is, it's a very conventional form of popular religion. The true teachings really don't survive. And you certainly get this from the Sadhana Mahamudra. So he was an authentic Vajrayana person, and he really had a sense of mission because the Vajrayana, although it arose in a Buddhist country, which is Tibet, well, India, and then moved to Tibet and was considered Buddhist, the Vajrayana is really unusual because it's not really about Buddhism. As I've already said, it's about the possibilities of human experience, period. And that was not understood. Usually the Vajrayana was tied up with Tibetan cultural values and a lot of the forms of Tibetan culture, the patriarchy, hierarchy, the stratified society that Tibet was, rich people at the top, poor people at the bottom, human rights questionable. It was tied up with a lot of stuff, and most Tibetans understood the Vajrayana as inseparable from Tibetan culture. And Rinpoche didn't, and that's what made him very unusual. And he, when the Chinese invaded, and Chinese were really kind of creating trouble from the early 50s on, and many people in Tibet knew that the end was near, his teacher said to him, you have to get out and you have to take these teachings to the world. These teachings are dead in Tibet. They're dead. They're finished. There's no future for them here. And you have to leave. You're going to have to escape. You're going to have to take them. And these teachings are not really meant for they're not meant for Tibet. Ultimately, they're not even meant for Buddhists. They're not even meant for religious people. They're meant for the human race. So he had a very strong sense of a mission. And it's sort of hard for us to put ourselves back in his situation as this young Tibetan guy who was around 20. He had been really immersed in this tradition. And it was, you know, really, when you look back, an incredibly amazing human tradition that he had been trained in, that he had been initiated into. He had spent years looking at his own mind, being challenged by all kinds of interesting teachers, and he had a couple who were very, very powerful teachers. He had been put into dark retreat where there's no light for weeks and even months on end. Well, not in his case, it was 49 days minus a few. But that's a long time to be in total pitch darkness. And in that process, you know, it's not, you're not doing that just for the sake of some kind of athletic endeavor or heroic accomplishment. You're doing it because when you spend time in retreat and when you spend time in dark retreat, you find out a lot of things. And what you find out is how much we hold back in our own life, how much we are not willing to experience our own lives openly and nakedly, how much when we go through our day and things happen to us, we're actually in the process of evasion and retreat and withdrawal. You find out how much life lies possible for you beyond the boundary of your own small, self-centered ego. It's a very shocking discovery, but it's a discovery that, as he reported it, as time went on for him in his training, he began to realize that we can actually live outside of the box of our own ego, and we can experience nature, we can see the sun, we can feel the wind on our face, we can taste water, we can see the beauty of a human face, and it's all happening without reference to ego. There is a possibility for all of us to live in a way that is so vast and so open and so joyful. And his Tibet, as Rinpoche often used to say, had very little to say for itself, except for this one thing, this one gift, this one cultural treasure, which is knowing about that, the full possibilities of the human person, and knowing how to activate it, knowing how to bring people into a life that is on the other side of the pettiness of our own ego. So he left Tibet very excited about this possibility of bringing these teachings to the rest of the world. And he arrived in India initially, and he was there for 5 years, from 1959 to 1964, roughly. And then he received a scholarship to study at Oxford, and he went to England in about 1964, and he was there until 1970, and he learned English, and he began to get to know Western people, and he began teaching. But didn't go very well, because he, you know, the people that he had met in Tibet, and particularly was a kind of self-selecting crowd that sort of showed up in his region and at his, where he lived and where he practiced. And these people were into it. I mean, the folks that were there, this is what they wanted for their lives. And they made enormous sacrifices for it. And particularly in Tibet, to, you know, practice these teachings, you had to kind of live a very tough life, because you had to, you know, beg your food in the summer, and you know, carry it to a cave, and then you had to sort of live in the cave and practice, and it was cold, and if you got sick, you had to wait until the snow melted in the spring, and a lot of times rats ate your food, and you didn't have enough food. It was very hard. And families in general did not look with favor upon young people that wanted to do this, but nevertheless, there were young people who were so inspired. There were young people who realized that somehow, at a young age, that they only had one human life, and this opportunity was there if they wanted it. And a lot of them said, this is what I want to do, and they did it. They practiced, and they achieved amazing things. And they achieved a kind of happiness that ordinary people really can't even conceive. There was a very famous Tibetan yogi named Milarepa, and he had as hard a life as anybody, and was kind of emaciated, and he had to live on nettle soup, because he didn't have food a lot of the time, and he was freezing cold. And when he was young, he'd had a fiance. And after he had taken up this meditative life in his cave, she came and visited him, and she said, you know, why don't you come down? You know, you're cold, you don't look that good, you're kind of green, you know, from all these nettles. You're too thin. You know, you don't have any flesh on you. You're cold all the time, and your food is kind of questionable. Why don't you come down to the valley? You know, you've been meditating for years. You could be a high lama. You could have people waiting on you hand and foot. And he said, not a chance. Because in my cave here, having absolutely nothing, I'm the happiest person on the planet. And he meant it, and he was right. He was. So this is the world that Trungpa Rinpoche came from. And when he came to the West, he thought that all of us were going to get it immediately. And, you know, because we have the material circumstances to really be able to pursue the path in a way that most Tibetans simply can't because of the amount of work in that kind of agrarian society that's necessary. So he went to England and he started teaching. And pretty soon he started to realize that people were treating him like their pet lama. That, you know, everybody in London had their own pet Rinpoche that they would talk about at their tea parties. But meantime, nobody really wanted to practice. They just wanted this exotic sort of Tibetan person in their life that they could refer to. And he started to become desperate, actually, desperate. And he didn't know what to do because he couldn't get through to these people. He had a few students who seemed serious, but most of them weren't. And he began to wonder whether the Western world was so deeply invested in its own habitual patterns that the possibility of the journey, the possibility of meditation, was really not going to be open. They would not be open to it. And that was when he went to Bhutan, to the cave of Taktsang, which is it's on the side of a cliff, and it is reputed to be the place where Padmasambhava, in similar circumstances, went to meditate. And so Rinpoche went to this cave because he didn't know what to do. And he was only there 3 weeks, but out of that retreat came the Sadhana Mahamudra. So that this text came out of a situation in his life of tremendous desperation and a sense of being trapped, cornered, a situation of not knowing what to do. And as he felt, the only thing he had to offer life in general was the teachings. And if he couldn't teach, he'd rather die. So that was where this text came from. And as often in human life, it's the really desperate situations where things happen. And so it was with him. So he went through some things in London and in England and then in Scotland. After he came back from the retreat and composing this text, and we'll talk about it maybe a little bit later, he was basically thrown out of his own monastery that he had started in Scotland, and he was his Lama friend didn't like that he was teaching so openly to Westerners, because he was teaching the whole thing. You know, he wasn't holding anything back, and this friend of his didn't like it. So the friend called up the secret security police in England and said he was a security risk. Rumors were spread that Rinpoche gone insane. And he was basically kicked out, totally kicked out with no money, no nothing. And it was his wife, who was with him at that time, Diana, said it was the most desperate time of his life, even worse than before. And there came a time when he actually was ready to kill himself and was ready to do it, and Diana stopped him, luckily. But he was ready to go. Let's do it. Let's take these pills. It's over. I'm out of here. This isn't working. It's finished. The only reason I'm here is to teach, and if I can't teach, I'll die, and I will die. And she, luckily, she stopped him, although she was only 19 years old and didn't know what the hell was going on. So, but he knew that England wasn't going to work, and so he managed to get a plane ticket to the United States, and he came to Boulder, Colorado, and his first gig, so to speak, was at the university. And he set up a center in Vermont. And in 1970, when I met him, because he went to Vermont first before he came out here, he was delivering the full measure of his lineage. After he left England, he had had a very serious automobile accident, which contributed to the desperation of his situation, became paralyzed on the left side for the rest of his life, and then thrown out of his monastery, and then branded insane. So he was in a very desperate place. His wife said, this person who had been very kind of joyful and sort of very bright and kind of constantly, you know, filled with the love of lineage, he suddenly became very dark and very heavy and incredibly intense. And that's when I met him. And he was the most frightening person you have ever been around, because he had been through so much that even the least bit of your little ego trips and your attempt to manipulate him or impress him or control him, he burned through it with his awareness. It was like being in the presence of an acetylene blowtorch that was cosmic in proportions. And anytime you tried anything, you were obliterated. And it wasn't that he did anything. You see, this is the interesting point. It was his awareness. His awareness was so intense and so powerful that it was like being around him was like walking into a force field where your little ego kind of sleazy little attempt to kind of maneuver and manipulate and position yourself was totally exposed. And everybody felt it who was around him. And his, this is the abrupt approach in Vajrayana Buddhism, that the teacher, by the field of his own awareness, cuts through whatever self-deception, whatever mask you're putting up, whatever game you're trying to play, whatever armor you have. He just cuts through, and he does it by his state of being. And he initially thought that was going to do it. That was going to do the job. That he would just come and he would teach, he would present the teachings, and we would all get it, and we would all practice, and we would all make the journey. And he really put it out, 1970, 1971, 1972. And if you go back and listen. You know, there's an archive now of his talks in those early years. If you go back and listen, it's actually unbelievable what you hear, the level of energy. Sometimes you feel like you're going to pass out, even listening to the tape. It's that intense. So, but what he saw was, and you know, this is, I'm kind of going through this with you because this is part of our journey here. We have to be realistic about what actually happened, and we have to be realistic about our own possibilities and also our own limitations as modern people. What he found out was actually that initially there was a tremendous amount of inspiration by this early group. You know, my generation, the 1970 folks, 1971 folks, 1972 folks, those were sort of, I would say, the years when he wasn't holding anything back at all. But what happened was we were incredibly inspired and we started doing retreats and then we started freaking out. And we started freaking out because we started to realize that the Dharma isn't about escaping from our lives. And at that time, you know, particularly in the early 70s, all of us were, you know, kind of hippies and counterculture, and we were very much against Western culture and against Western religion. And it was very sort of, you know, against our parents and so on. And what we found out, and he told us this, but with the real heavy part was we figured it out through our practice, was that what this whole tradition is about is taking off the coverings of the person that we currently are, of opening up the experience of our present life, of making ourselves naked to the situations and the emotions and the people that are us, that are our current human existence. And that's, he taught that's what genuine spirituality is. It's not moving away from who we are, it's moving closer to who we are and becoming more open to who we are. And when we do that, you know, our thought is that, well, I'm not a very good person, I don't have a lot of capacity, you know, I can't really do this or whatever. You know, we have a very sort of heavy negative self-image. That's what we think. And so we think, and we thought, if we do that, we're just going to sort of descend into some kind of cesspool and never get out. We thought spirituality was about getting rid of who we are in our current lives and doing something glorious and high. And his point was, it's not that at all. It's actually genuine spirituality is the redemption of the life that we already have. And it's the discovery of the person that we already are. And when we do that, we find that everything that we have ever longed for and ever wanted is there. Not, amazingly enough, not even in a purely spiritual sense, but in a mundane sense. All of the human longings that come from childhood for us, all of the unfulfilled aspirations of adolescence, all of the deep yearnings that we have as adults, all of them are waiting for us in all of their fullness and fulfillment when we open to the person that we already are. That's the message of Vajrayana. So we all freaked out because it was so contrary to what the whole culture told us. It was contrary to our Judeo-Christian heritage that told us that the earth is low and sexuality is not spiritual and the human body is something to be despised and rejected. I mean, even though a lot of us didn't really believe that, it's so deeply rooted, it's throughout our whole culture and it's throughout the whole secular culture and the way in which our economic system works. This sort of rendition of the despised nature of ordinary life. So a lot of things happened, and a lot of us stopped practicing, and a lot of us didn't, we were kind of freaked out by the abrupt approach, as I was mentioning before, where you're there, you're talking to the man, and suddenly he not only rips off your clothes, he rips off your skin. Only he doesn't do anything. See, that's the bad part. Because it's not like Rinpoche stopped doing it. You can't really say that. Because the man is just there. It's his awareness that's doing it. But he began to see that we were a little more shaky than we were presenting ourselves to be. And so from 73, 74, when Naropa started and afterwards, he began to realize that he needed to create a more gradual approach to the preparing his students for the legacy, you know, for Vajrayana Buddhism, for being fully human, whatever you want to say. And that's what we have today is, you know, if you read his things or if you follow his path, and today very few people actually do follow the actual path he taught, but if you meet, if you happen to meet people who do follow the path that he taught, you'll find that it's a much more gradual approach. You know, you do Hinayana, you meditate, then you take your Bodhisattva vow, you take transmission, you do your Nundro, you do your sadhana practice, you practice Mahamudra. You know, there's a whole graded path that he taught. And most people eventually needed it. In fact, everybody did, because the abrupt approach, we couldn't handle it. We could not handle the reality. We couldn't handle the nakedness. We couldn't handle the intensity of experience. So it's interesting that one of the keynotes of this sadhana is that it brings together the two main contemplative traditions of Tibetan Buddhism. And it's interesting that one of the traditions is known as the old school of Nyingma, and it specializes in the abrupt approach or crazy wisdom. And the other approach is the new translation schools, and you know, I know this doesn't mean that much to most of you, but we'll try to kind of flesh it out. And that approach is a gradual approach. So the sadhana itself actually is bringing together the abrupt approach of crazy wisdom and the gradual approach of creating a stairway to the experience of the awakened state. And in the sadhana, what we're looking at is an integration of these two approaches that in Tibet were a little bit separate. The reason this is important is in Chogyam Trungpa's life, they are brought together, and in what ended up being his training, they are also brought together. So if you study his lineage now, and it's actually very hard to actually study his lineage, you know, what he actually taught and the path that he taught, but if you can figure out a way to do that, what you'll find is that it has both the abrupt approach of crazy wisdom, which we experienced in the 1970s and made our hair stand on end. I mean, if we had hair, some of us had hair at that time. And then the gradual approach of that there's a gradual way to work your way toward it. So that's what we're going to find in the sadhana, this integration. And that really became his great gift. His great gift was uniting those two. Now, this might be a slightly overly technical point, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway. If you have only the crazy wisdom approach, for Western people, it makes you mentally a little unstable, frankly. You're a little wacky because it's so out there. It's like outer space. So you need the gradual approach to create a container so that you can experience the awakened state and all of its wildness and all of its splendor. The gradual approach provides a container. But if you only have the gradual approach, which is what we find almost everywhere in Tibetan Buddhism today, not everywhere, but almost everywhere. Rinpoche said it's like being a worm chewing through your leaves, and you just go around your tree over and over and over, and there's no vastness. The awakened state is long since forgotten. So the abrupt approach of crazy wisdom and the gradual approach, either one by itself doesn't really quite work, and it really doesn't work for Westerners, but putting them together totally works. And that's his legacy, and that's his lineage. And there's nowhere where that's found more clearly than in this text. In the text, it's completely there. So it's going to be fun to kind of look at it and consider it and see, you know, how he thinks we can do it, how he thinks we can make this journey.
More of Reggie's teachings, find out about upcoming retreats, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Ketchog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.